Okay, all you need to do is go to the live stream on Rumble
okay.
and just watch the comment section. And also field the comments.
Okay.
You never know what's going to pop up. Read the question before you actually read it out loud.
If there's a question on Rumble, what do I do?
We're going to tell them at the end we'll have a Q&A.
Oh.
But it's really just kind of going back and saying, yes, there are, there aren't. There's probably not going to be that many people on the live yet. Just because I only told a select few, because I knew it would probably be a rough go the first time. Are you ready, Darren?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. First and foremost, I want to say thank you to Mrs. Pam Newton for hosting us here at the Treehouse. It's fantastic. And, of course, all of my favorite people in the world are here, and I love you guys, and I appreciate you for being here. The idea is this law course that we're going to start. It's the Citizens Law Course, if you will. And the idea is I'm not teaching you, we're learning together, right? Because eventually you'll start understanding too once we get in it more. There's so much things that need to be contemplated. You need to digest things by having conversations, different things like that. And the goal of this first one is to lay the foundation of what, where our law comes from, because you can actually then go back. The idea is here is if you take notes of all of these, the names of the people that we're talking about and so on, you'll be able to go back and read like Blackstone and Lord Cook and Vattel and different people like that. You'll be able to go back and read their commentaries, and it will give you an incredible understanding of what's really going on in our law instead of listening to other people. Like the goal is once we move through this, you're finding answers yourself. You're not asking someone else to tell you. You're going to figure it out for yourself. You're going to say, okay, I hear what you're saying, but you got to show me that in the law. I've got to be able to see how it could be applied. Because it doesn't matter what people say. If you go into a court, it's all hearsay, unless it's established as a fact, right? So we're just not here to play those, you know, patriot mythology games, if you will. We want to talk about real, true solutions. And the reality is Alexis de Tocqueville came to America right after the Constitution was written. And he, you know, he's a self-funded elitist, if you will, a good guy, though, a very wealthy individual from France. And he came over. And he spent 9 months here, went all over the United States. And he asked frontiersmen, people in the cities, everybody. And he was blown away that every single person he talked to, no matter their education level or whatnot, or their status of finances, had a complete understanding of the law. And there was nothing. He said, he was basically, there's nothing that's going to be able to penetrate that because the people understand what should be done. And then therefore, you know, if you have all of those checks and balances, those are the real checks and balances of the people. Having that understanding is what really is going to make the difference. So that's what we're going to do here. And again, for anybody that's just coming in the live chat, we'll have a Q&A at the end. So you're more than welcome to put your questions in the chat as they come to you, or you can hold on to them until the end. But we will do everything we can to answer all the questions possible. And today is going to be, again, the foundational history of American law, American common law, where it came from, and kind of giving you an understanding, you know, what the Magna Carta is, what the Declaration of Independence was standing on, the Treaty of Paris, and just really making you confident in what our law is supposed to be. So I'll go ahead and get started. So American law, an introduction. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And this is Psalm 11:3, and that's the obvious reason for this, is because when we forget who we are, we lose everything. And so this is the restoration of our foundations. Thankfully, they're still there, alive and well. All that's missing is the people being aware of them and actually asserting those rights. All right, so common law from West Encyclopedia of Law, second edition, says, the ancient law of England, based on societal customs and recognized and enforced by the judgment and decrees of the court, the principles and rules of action embodied in case law rather than legislature enactments, applicable to the government and protection of persons and property that derive their authority from the community customs and traditions that evolved over the centuries as interpreted by judicial tribunals. It's a very important thing to understand. It's based upon societal customs. We go back to early England, right before the Norman invasion. That's where the hundreds came from, right? And the families of 100 families would get together and they would self-govern. And they all were Christian-based. No matter what anybody says, this is where our law comes from, is God's word. And they were Christian-based, and they got together, and they were taking care of each other. They were responsible. They even had a law and a custom where the whole county would be responsible for something that one of your members did. And the purpose of that was to keep everybody accountable and hold that balance up together. And so a lot of the times, you know, that really emphasized and incentivized the self-governance, because people were working together. They were also controlling who was involved in their assemblies, in their hundreds, right? If they didn't think the same way, they didn't have the same principles, because the law is based on principles and customs, then they were kicked out. You know what I mean? So you have to be diligent in that kind of stuff.
Hey, Josh, the folks on the live stream are probably going to have difficulty seeing that, the PowerPoint.
Uh-huh.
So will we have that available?
Yes, we can absolutely provide the PowerPoint out.
Okay.
Yeah, in the PDF form, so everybody can, no matter the type of computer. So again, instead of just being arbitrary codes and statutes, right, it's principles and rules. And so those are the things that really govern. And to be honest, it made it a lot easier and a lot more simple. And of course, it also brought in, discretion, being able to use your God-given discernment, your gut, understanding people, and so on. So this is Emmerich de Vattel. And so De Vattel was a Swiss jurist who applied a theory of natural law to international relations. He wrote The Law of Nations in 1758, and he was instrumental in the founders' framing of American law because of his aligned ideals of liberty and equality. All right, and so everything that the founders, well, not everything, but a lot of the stuff that the founders did, they look back to his treatise. Okay, so this is it right here. This is The Law of Nations. And so it just goes through. It's very simplistic. It's actually not, it's one of the easiest law books I've ever read. You know, and obviously I haven't read it all. But it goes through, you know, all the different things that are required for a nation or a state. Remember, state and nation are correlated. They're the same word, synonymous. To be able to be dependent, to be able to be dependent on their laws and so on, to be strong, and to be what the people have called it to be. And of course, he applied natural law to the theory of law itself. And so natural law is a system or justice, a system of right or justice held to common all humans and derived from nature rather than from the rules of society. And of course, remember how Thomas Jefferson said, derived from nature and nature's God. This is the kind of understanding that they're talking about. And the Bible tells us that the laws of God are written on every man's heart, right? So in other words, we naturally know what's right. And this is what the idea was. Well, then the law, instead of being arbitrary based on some tyrant's dictates, should be based on natural law, because that's the way everybody correlates, and that's how we have peace in society. And so this is the biggest thing, too. I thought this is just really appropriate for what we're going on, but he has a section that says a nation ought to know itself, right? And so this is actually out of it directly. It says, without this knowledge, it cannot make any successful endeavors after its own perfection. It ought to have a just idea of its state to enable it to take the most proper measures. It ought to know the progress it has already made and what further advances it has to still make, what advantages it possesses and what defects it labors under in order to preserve the former and correct the latter. Without this knowledge, a nation will act at random and often take the most improper measures. It will think it acts with great wisdom in imitating the conduct of nations that are reputed wise and skillful, not perceiving that such or such regulation or such or such practice, though salutary to one state, is often pernicious to another. Everything ought to be conducted according to its nature. Nations cannot be well governed without such regulations as are suitable to their respective characters. And in order to do this, characters ought to be known. So it's very important. Basically, what they're saying is the people have to know who they are and what they're supposed to be. When you're acting in opposition to what our rights are, what we are supposed to be, I mean, look at our borders, right? Wide open. Well, why are they wide open? Because the people that are in charge are actually trying to destroy us. But they've been able to get away with it for so long because we haven't known the nation that we are. So when people start appealing to bleeding hearts and saying, oh, but the immigrants have to come in and we have to accept everybody and give me your poor, give me your hungry. Like, listen, we know who we are, okay? You're more than welcome to come in the right way, and you're going to go through the process because we hold a standard, and nobody else is coming into that standard unless you're willing to help us progress who we are, our character of our nation. And so when you go through this kind of stuff, it's very apparent that there's been an infiltration and a true plan and plot to destroy us from within. because nothing that's happening is making sense, right? I think it was Arizona and Texas both put borders down, and then the feds came in and tore them down. It's just wild. All right, so now we're going to get into the Magna Carta. And so this happened in 1215, and Magna Carta just means the Great Charter. And it's funny because the only reason it was called that is because they did one first, and then they did another one, and it was just on a bigger piece of paper. And so it was the bigger charter. So Magna Carta is bigger charter is what it means. Now, the Great Charter, or the Magna Carta, it was signed on June 15th, at 1215, in the year 1215, at Runnymede by King John in acquiescence to the rebel barons. So what had happened is King John was basically becoming a tyrant. And so the barons, who were labeled the rebel barons, right, they were done with it. And they kind of went to war with the king in and of itself, and then finally brought the king to a neutral ground, which was Runnymede. They used every avenue that they could think of in order to do it. They even offered to make Prince Louis from France the king, and that's what got King John interested in paying attention. But they basically, at the blade of a knife, had him sign this Magna Carta. Now, it didn't take effect right away, or it did, and then he broke it immediately because he tried to get the Pope to nullify it. The Pope did, and the baron said, "We don't care. We don't care who you are or anything else." And so eventually, after a few years, it was completely instituted and added some things about the forestry and different stuff like that, which is actually included in the document that we had with the assemblies. But the point of it was we had freedom of elections, secured individual liberties, instituted the common law, grand jury, and then elevated the law of the land above the king. So before, the king was just running amok, being able to do whatever he wanted to do. But it's incredible when I'm reading this and studying it, everything that we hold dear in this nation came from this, for the most part. I mean, almost everything. And then you see what these people were doing. Because, no one's making laws to prevent something unless it's something they've suffered. You know, and so they were going through this whole issue. It says, in the very beginning, in the first place, we have granted to God, and by this our present charter confirmed for us and our heirs forever, that the English church shall be free, and shall have her rights entire and her liberties inviolate. And we will that it be thus observed, which is apparent from this, that the freedom of elections, which is reckoned most important and very essential to the English church, and this we will observe, and our will is that it be observed in good faith by our heirs forever. And that's actually us too, because we were the heirs that came over from the founding. Those were their descendants, right? And so this is the kind of thing that came down. They knew back then, obviously, that fair elections were important. Because if not, then you're going to get corruption in the government that's supposed to actually uphold the law that protects the people. It also says, we have also granted to all freemen of our kingdom, for us and our heirs forever, all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs, of us and our heirs forever. This was the inspiration for our Bill of Rights, or the Bill of Prohibitions. So one of the things he was talking about was the local courts of record. So they used to have to chase the king around because he was actually on the move all the time, collecting his tribute and so on. And so if they had courts, they had to go find where the king was and then actually follow his court around and hold court. And so it was obviously a horrible system of justice, because if the king was on the other side of the country and you had a dispute that needed to be handled, you were pretty much out of luck. Right, and not only that, but going to court and then having the other party show up, it's highly unlikely. So in the 17th, either you can call it the section or the article, but common pleas, which are just your common courts, shall not follow our court. And so another thing too is when they're saying our and us, you need to think of that as the government, right? And it shall not follow our court, but shall be held in some fixed place. In other words, we're going to give you all local courts for local self-governance. And then in civil criminal cases, it shall not be held elsewhere than their own county courts with four knights of the county chosen by the county. So the people were still heavily involved in picking whoever they were going to be involved with, whoever was going to quote-unquote govern over them. This one's huge. So remember how we always hear, I'm supposed to be judged by my peers, but you can't find it in the Constitution. It doesn't say the peers, but this is where it comes back to. This statement about the peers and honorable men, that things can't be done unless it's in front of them, is mentioned over and over and over, right? And it was all, you can't just decide on your own that you're going to come after somebody or do something, you need to have witnesses. And then if people are going to be, you know, lose their homes, put in prison, fined, whatever the case may be, it has to be by the judgment of their peers, right? The lawful judgment of their peers. And then it says, the nobles shall not be punished except through their peers, right? But remember, what we have to understand is all of this consolidated with us, right? There was no more tiers. It was always, we're all nobles, we're all kings, whatever, however you want to look at it. So, but every line of different class of citizen, even back then, still could not have stuff done unless it was through the judgment of their peers. And it shall be lawful for our sheriff or bailiff to collect debts at the sight of lawworthy men. In other words, you couldn't come in and take somebody's debt. So there had to be people from the county there that were lawworthy men, upstanding integrity, that would actually be there to witness it was being done properly. Right? So it's a check and balance to make sure that things were done. Also, due process, which is full of it. And really, that's the, what we were talking about before is due process, but wanted to kind of segment the category so that it's better to understand. But no constable or other bailiff of ours shall take corn or other provisions from anyone without immediately tendering money, therefore, unless he can have postponement thereof by permission of the seller. So obviously, the government was taking stuff, right, all the time. And so the idea is you know, that's really a taking of property without due process. That's what it would relate to with us, right? And that's our, I think, the 9th or 10th article or section of the first article in our Missouri Constitution talks about we will not lose any life or property without due process of law. No sheriff or bailiff of ours or other person shall take the horses or carts of any freeman for transport duty against the will of said freeman. And neither we nor our bailiff shall take for our castles or for any other work of ours wood which is not ours against the will of the owner of that wood. It says, now no bailiff for the future shall, upon his own unsupported complaint, put anyone to his law without credible witnesses brought for this purpose. Do you know how this really correlates to? A ticket. Right? Because the police officer is bringing an unsupported claim of something that you did wrong, that you're going to be fined for, right, without any credible witnesses, right? And so this is kind of the transition, and you'll start to understand, too, that's civil codes, right? Statutes, civil codes, and so on. It's not the same thing as our common law, which if we're being brought to court and summoned to court, there's a specific due process of how to summon me to court, right? Giving me a ticket or giving me a screenshot of a ticket is not what the process is supposed to be, right? But that's how lax and ridiculous it's gotten. No freeman shall be taken or imprisoned or deceased, or it says diseased, but it should say diseased and autocorrect, and that just means property taken, or exiled, or in any way destroyed, except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. If anyone has been dispossessed or removed by us without the legal judgment of his peers from his lands, castles, franchises, or from his right, we will immediately restore them to him. And if a dispute arises over this, then let it be decided by the 5 and 20 barons of whom mention is made below. And that's actually the foundation of the grand jury, or the jury itself. It started out as a grand jury, then, of course, molded and moved into a petit jury and so on. But these people, if there was ever a dispute, it was decided by the jury, right, by the noble, lawful people, or the men of the law. This is fun. It's kind of a freedom to travel, right? So it says, it shall be lawful in future for anyone to leave our kingdom and return safe and secure by land and water, except for a short period in time of war on grounds of public policy, reserving always the allegiance due to us. So basically, they were obviously having issues where they couldn't leave and come back because they were charging them for it or different things like that. Now it's basically saying you always have the right to travel outside, to come back. This is your realm. You have access to it. Free and equal justice, nothing in future shall be given or taken for a writ of inquisition of life or limbs, but freely it shall be granted and never denied. So a writ of inquisition is saying an order to look into something. And so if somebody was having an issue and they needed the government or the courts to look into it, they used to make them, they would take something from them, right? They would make them pay for justice, if you will. And this was ensuring that that didn't happen again, that justice would remain free and never denied. And then to no one will we sell, to no one will we refuse or delay right or justice, right? And so that's the right to a speedy trial, different things like that. This is where all this stuff comes from. I mean, again, 1215. That's a long time ago for these things to be established. But it's taken, you know, it takes that kind of time for people to be pushed out of it and not know what's going on. But the idea was it should be free. It actually goes back, I think, in our Constitution, it talks about the clerk cannot postpone filing your stuff for a fee. But they do it anyways. We will appoint as justices constables, sheriffs, or bailiffs, only such men as know the law of the realm and mean to observe it well. In other words, people who were educated in what the law was, that the law was the protection and the preservation of the rights of the people, and they weren't going to put anybody, somebody's cousin or somebody's kid or somebody's nephew in there because they have high status. They got to know the law, right? And obviously they were getting jerked around with this, otherwise they wouldn't have created a law or an article for it. Equal protection. Moreover, all these aforesaid customs and liberties, the observances of which we have granted in our kingdom as far as pertains to us towards our men, shall be observed by all of our kingdom, as well clergy as laymen, as far as pertains to them towards their men. In other words, everybody in the entire realm, doesn't matter within the church or without the church, everybody has equal protection of the law. And then the extent of the law's remedy. So this is section 62. And hold on 1 second. I'll do that one first. I actually got those mixed up. So establishment of the grand jury. So this is actually the article that brings out the grand jury. And it says, since, moreover, for God in the amendment of our kingdom and for the better allaying of the quarrel that has arisen between us and our barons, we have granted all these concessions, desirous that they should enjoy them in complete and firm endurance forever. We give and grant to them the underwritten security, namely, that the barons choose 25 barons of the kingdom, whomsoever they will, who shall be bound with all their might to observe and hold and cause to be observed the peace and liberties we have granted and confirmed to them by this our present charter. Understand what he's saying here. It's saying, in order to ensure that you have securities for this, we're going to allow you to create a grand jury. And that grand jury's whole job is to ensure that your rights are preserved, right? So the grand jury was literally the security of all of these things to make sure they happen properly. Because it was really the grand jury was over everyone, even the king, right? And so that if we or our justiciar, our judges, our justice system, or our bailiffs, or any one of our officers shall in anything be at fault towards anyone, or shall have broken any one of the articles of this peace or of this security, and the command compel the same to swear to the effect foresaid, and if any one of the 25 barons shall have died or departed from the land or be incapacitated in any manner, basically they'll be able to use some other people to have the jurisdiction. And then if perchance these 25 are present and disagree about anything, or if some of them after being summoned are unwilling or unable to be present, that which majority of those present ordain or command shall be held as fixed and established. In other words, if not everybody can show up, whoever you have there is enough. You can still bring it to pass. And we shall procure nothing from anyone, directly or indirectly, whereby any part of these concessions and liberties might be revoked or diminished. And if any such things has been procured, let it be void and null, and we shall never use it personally or by another. In other words, we're not going to charge for it, and we're not going to bribe anybody, basically. In other words, the government has no hand in it. Now, if you think about our grand juries, it's just supposed to be the grand jury and the foreman. Even though the feds are in there all the time, the prosecutors are in there all the time, it's because the people aren't intelligent enough or educated enough to understand what the differences are, what their rights are. And the fact, like, I think that Red Beckman video that I watched talking about if the grand jury brings an indictment and the DA says, oh, we're not going to prosecute, the grand jury should then indict the DA for obstruction of justice. And if they do it, the DA doesn't do it, and the judge doesn't do it, they should indict the judge, right? And so this is the understanding of the power of the grand jury that exists today, right? Same thing with jury nullification. You know, we have the right to judge the law and the facts, not just the law, or not just the facts, right, if they add up. If we think a law is unjust in the way that it's being administered to somebody, we have the right to come back and say, no, we don't think this person is guilty, and they can't do anything about it, right? They even talk about how jury nullification still exists, and they say a relic of the past that's held on to, but it's still held on to, right? It still has the authority that it has. They won't allow you, though. They rule that you can't tell the jury in court that they could nullify this because you don't want to prejudice the jury, right? But the reality is you can absolutely. And that's one of the big things that Red Beckman was doing, was going around and educating everybody in the grand jury training, which this is kind of going to incorporate into that. But they were seeing all kinds of great effects when people were actually getting, you know, you educate and go around and do hundreds of seminars in your state. Well, you're going to get some good jurors, and it only takes one vote to hang the jury, right? And so you get that one vote, you can change everything. We have to understand how important our voice is when it comes to that stuff. And then we'll go back up to this, the extent of the law's remedy. This is really just really interesting to me. They have the ability to go in and seize. They basically said, if we don't give you remedy in the time prescribed, you have the ability to go in and seize our castles, seize our land, seize our property with the whole community, the whole county, whatever, however many people are involved, bring it all in. You can seize everything except keep us alive. Don't kill our wives. Don't kill the kids, right? But you can hold on to it as long as you want until we've remitted to you exactly what's due. It's up to you if you're satisfied or not. That's the kind of law this was laying down, right? And so there was a lot riding on this. But as you can tell, just the same with us now, if you don't have numbers, right, you don't really have too much. You can stand on your own liberties, but if you really want to make an adjustment or a change in the government, you have to have numbers. All right, and so the last portion of it is they basically saying they decreed and confirmed it by an oath. Wherefore, we will and firmly order that the English church be free, and that the men in our kingdom have and hold all the aforesaid liberties, rights, and concessions, well and peaceably, freely and quietly, fully and wholly, for themselves and their heirs, of us and our heirs, in all respects and in all places, forever, as is aforesaid. An oath, moreover, has been taken, as well as on our parts as on the part of the barons, that all these conditions aforesaid shall be kept in good faith and without evil intent. Right? And so that's kind of where our oaths and everything come from, to the Constitution, different things like that. This and the freely and quietly, you know, that well and peaceably, freely and quietly. You have a right to privacy. You have a right to the quiet, to not be bothered or anything else like that. And that's really what's harping on, if you will. All right, so we're going to go into a couple common law patriarchs. This is a short section, but they're very important. If you want to go back and read their readings, you'll see a couple quotes, and it should ring some bells. Of stuff that you may have never heard. So these were the ones who came after. So 1215 was the Magna Carta, and these people, Lord Sir Edward Coke. It's spelled Coke. Everybody says Coke, but then I was listening to a historian that's a specialist on this individual, and he says Cook. But if you type in, I mean, if I say Cook and then you type in Cook, you're not going to find this guy for the most part. But Sir Edward Coke, or Cook, he was an English jurist and politician. He was born in 1552 in Norfolk, England, and his biggest thing was the defense of the supremacy of the common law against the Stuart claims of royal prerogative, had a profound influence on the development of English law and the English Constitution. And so he was elevated into a position where he had the authority to judge accordingly, and even though the king would come in, or the royals would come in and say, no, we want it this way, he was actually the one standing in the gap. So during the time, he was very popular with some people and very hated with others. But he stood in the gap, and he was the one who laid a very strong, solid foundation for the English common law. He says, "No man is above," these are his quotes, "no man is above the law, and it is the duty of the courts to hold everyone accountable, regardless of their status or power." Right? And we hear these jacklegs talking about Trump all the time. No one's above the law. They don't even know who said it. You know, they don't even know where it comes from, what our common law is, or anything else like that. They're a bunch of communists. But it's interesting to see that where these actually source from. You know, instead of people just saying it, it's actually a statement that was held and revered that we built our law on. And this one is, I think, fantastic, too. "It is the duty of judges to interpret the law and protect the rights of the people, even if it means standing against the will of the king." It's fantastic, right? And this is what this individual believed. And standing on those principles, again, continue to make our law. But when we go back and we see from the beginning the definition of common law, it's based on principles and rules, right? So those are these principles that our law is supposed to be based on. You have to do what's right. Another one who is actually probably one of my favorites is Sir William Blackstone. So he came almost 150 years later. He's born July 10th, 1723 in London, and he authored the Commentaries on the Laws of England from 1765 to 69, which became the basis of university legal education in England and North America. If you want to get really a great book to read, and it will elevate your vocabulary quite a bit. It may be hard at first to read, but once you get into it and understand it, it's actually very enjoyable. But the Commentaries on the Laws of England, all right, you can go that. And there's a bunch of different people who've put together books for or with his writings about Lord Blackstone and so on. And he got knighted later for the work he did in the law. But these two individuals are absolutely paramount. They still reference Blackstone a lot of the times in court as well. I'm sorry, not in court, in law courses or law classes, law school. And he says, the first and primary duty of government is the protection of individual rights and freedom. And so they have a ton of fantastic quotes that you can read about these, but I was going through and it's like, this is exactly what we need to understand. The whole point of the government is to protect our individual rights and our freedoms, first and foremost, right? First and primary. And then, you know, our Constitution, Missouri Constitution says, in Section 2 of Article 1, that all constitutional government is intended to promote the general welfare of the people, that all persons have a natural right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the enjoyment of the gains of their own industry, that all persons are created equal and entitled to equal rights and opportunity under the law, and that to give security to these things is the principal office of government, and that when government does not confer this security, it fails in its chief design. But we can see that the founders in the Missouri Constitution were looking back to this man as well, right? This is our common law. This is the thread that we all stand on. All right, so now we're moving to the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. And so one thing I want to press on you is the fact that those rights already existed, right? And that's why a lot of people say that the Revolutionary War is a misname, right? It should actually be the Colonialist War or the Colonial War, because they were just fighting for rights they already had. The king had gone off the rails, right? So it wasn't that, I mean, 1215 all the way up until the 1700s, obviously that's 500 plus years of history of having those rights, right? With people going before them and really helping establish them. They had, the king had taken a turn for the worse. So it says, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And impel is a fantastic word that means drive them, force them into this situation. It's really kind of the same place we are now. That's why we're all here. Right? They messed up our lives and our comfort is gone now, and there's something we are impelled to do. But then it always goes back to nature and nature's God. That's where it all comes back to. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, obviously, we can tell that that's going back, right, to Lord Coke and to Lord Blackstone as well, and understanding that this is exactly what the purpose was. That's what they were codifying in the Magna Carta, was the government is supposed to exist to better the people, because in reality, a king's a king, but if his people revolt, he's not a king anymore, right? And so the connection is, especially in that feudal relationship, was, we'll take care of you if you keep loyal and take care of us. Of course, it always got out of hand, and that's when the people stepped in and started writing out their rights. Also, word that stood out to me specifically today is among. It's in the midst of, not over. Government is in the midst of men, not over men, right? And that's a very important point to understand, is we're not governments capitalized, men capitalized, right? They're both proper nouns in that sense. They're both giving their due respect, but it doesn't say over. It says among. And then it goes on to talk about the consent of the governed, right? that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It's not up to anybody else whatsoever. What you think is right, what you think is wrong, that's the power the people hold. And of course, this is the people assembled, right? Because I can't come up with a law that's going to bind you or vice versa, right? That's where we're going to go. And we're going to write the original law with our constitution. And then from there, then the government start writing their laws, right? But the people wrote their original laws. And we've already laid out and said what they can and can't do. And that's really how you should be able to judge if a law is just, if a law applies to you. If the law only applies to you, if you're described in the statutes or whatnot, and also if it's not, even if you're described and it's infringing on your rights, it's null and void, right? And everything goes back to the principles. Another thing to look at too is this was written before the Constitution, right? So these are the principles. All this stuff was before the Constitution. The Constitution didn't do anything but secure what was already ours, right? It didn't give us any rights. It just secured what God had already given us. And this is a list of abuses, just so that I think it's important to understand what was actually happening, right? And this is not exhaustive. This is just some of the things that they line out in the Declaration. And it was the king refused to sign off on the establishment of American judiciary. In other words, he wouldn't let them have American judges. All the other judges were paid by him, therefore in his pocket, right? And that leads us back to the understanding of where we were with the SCOTUS, right? Having their tenure forever, they can't have their pay changed or anything else like that. That's what that goes back to. They're supposed to be independent. Because the only other option is if they're not independent, they're going to be dependent on somebody. They rendered the military independent and superior to civil power, right? And so there not only was the people no longer in charge of the government or had the oversight of the military, they were completely off on their own. That's why they were having all these conflicts, right, with the colonials, the colonists, and they were actually superior. The civil power had no place among them. He assented to colorable legislation contrary to the Constitution. In other words, he wouldn't approve their laws, but he was approving other laws that were in direct contradiction to the Constitution, and nobody to hold him accountable because he also had the judges in his pocket. He wouldn't give us any judges over here, right? He was controlling everything. It was imposition of new taxes without the people's consent. So wait a minute. The people used to have to consent to taxes before, right? They had that right? They did. It's in the Magna Carta, too, that they actually had to have a town meeting the same way we have our county voting, right, to come together to approve a cell phone tax or not. But this is historic as far as the way that our rights were given to us, right? And then depriving trial by jury, which is obviously a big deal. And extraditing American colonists to England for prosecution, and a lot of the time for made-up charges, right? They were, you know, standing on their own 2 feet. They were standing against all the unlawful things that the king were doing, so they just snatched them up and said, okay, we're going to go ahead and take you over into England. We're going to try you in our courts, and good luck. And we know, if we go back to Magna Carta, they're losing all their rights. They don't have that grand jury there anymore. They don't have a trial by their peers, right? They have a completely different people as far as who's looking in and deciding what's right and what's wrong. They also plundered the seas, they ravaged our coast, they burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. That is the tyrannical government gone wrong. Legitimately, right? They had all these secured rights, all these liberties, and this is what they were doing to them, right? And so that's why he talks about it towards the end. You know, it said history has shown us that people will put up with things until they can't. Right? And then they rise up. And that's really what was going on. And he said every single time that he's done this, we have been humble. We have done, pleading, asking for redress, all this other stuff, and we were ignored. And now you've pushed us to this point. Cutting off trade with the world, of course, that's a huge deal as well, because if they can't get trade, then they're interdependent on each other there, as well as now, you know, the East India Company and different stuff like that, all owned by the crown, operated by the crown. I can't get trade with people autonomously on my own, well, then you control the trade routes, and now you can set the prices. You know, standing armies in times of peace without legislative consent, and then wrap that up with them being independent and superior to the civil power, right? It was just a bad situation altogether. There's no justice in those type of situations because they're on two different playing fields. And then continuous dissolving of the legislature. So he just kept dissolving the legislature by decree so they couldn't get anything done. I mean, he was totally stifling them. And if you read through it, it really seems like he even stopped their naturalization process of bringing in foreigners because he didn't want them to come in. He was afraid he was losing control, and that's exactly what was actually happening. But instead, just like with King John, actually, he was trying to hold on to his crown back in Magna Carta, right? And so he was going around fighting, and then he ended up, because he was in such haste, crossing a river that hadn't dried all the way with all of his treasures, the crown and everything, sunk into the mire, lost everything anyways, and then got sick and died. All because he was trying to hold on to control of something that he shouldn't have. He was fighting nature's law. And then so after all these abuses, they name we, therefore, and none of this, by the way, this is their capitalization. So the emphasis is only the color. That's all that I added. But we, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for rectitude of our intentions. In other words, God's going to judge if we've done it right or not. Do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of a right, ought to be free and independent states. And the big thing about that, the Declaration of Independence, that started, if you ever get the chance to watch the John Adams series, watch episode 2, it's the Declaration of Independence, fantastic. Because it shows you everything they were dealing with. Smallpox was on an outbreak, right? They were, Boston was getting raided. They had raised a militia. They were fighting to get the Congress to adopt the militia. That's why when Derek Johnson talks about the military existed before the country, is because they adopted the militia as the army, right? The Continental Army. But they were going through hell. They didn't just pop up one day and say, we're going to be independent. They were like, we have to get here. And John Adams and Samuel Adams were very, very important in all of this because it was their home that was getting raided. John Adams was right on the road from Boston, and all of the troops and everybody came by them. They could watch the gunfire going off of the boats. They could see, you know, the dead soldiers coming by and moving, or they're carrying the dead soldiers by and so on. They were right there in the mix of it, right? And so he had he obviously had a big dog in the fight as far as that's concerned, but they were willing to say what others were thinking, and because he said it, then people started going in motion. And then they were fighting about everything, and right before it kind of fell off, the king, being, you know, the personality he was, wrote a letter and a proclamation and called them all traitors. So they didn't have a choice. So it was really divine providence. Samuel Adams, they said, God save the king afterwards. Samuel Adams said, God damn the king. And then Benjamin Franklin was like, God bless the king, because nobody else could have brought unity to this Congress, you know? And so it's that statement comes in, we shall hang separately or together. And so it united them under that persecution. And then we go through the war, and we go to the Treaty of Paris. And this is really interesting, because this is the time, November 30th, 1782 is the actual official date, because it was backdated after ratified, but it was the actual official date we became free. You know, or we were acknowledged as free, right? And this was the treaty signed between England and the United States in Paris, and it was Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and John Adams that were there, and actually, they ignored the directions from Congress to not get France involved, put France to the side, and then work directly with England, really putting their lives on the line. But it worked out so well with what we ended up getting in the treaty that everybody was, you know, happy about it. But these men were taking risks that they felt were necessary to get us to where we're supposed to go. And this is what I love. You know how they say that, Benjamin Franklin didn't know God and Jefferson was a deist and all this other stuff? Well, there's only one Trinity, right? And this is the way the treaty starts out. In the name of the Holy and Undivided Trinity. Most holy and undivided Trinity, right? So these men knew who our God was. And I mean, it's the same reason they put it in everything else that we have. Because in reality, all the other gods don't really want the best for you. They want sacrifices. They want something to please them. God wanted us to be free. All right, so in the summaries of the articles, Article 1, it says, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states and relinquishes all claims to the government for property, propriety, and territorial rights of the same in every part thereof. You have some conspiracy theories out there saying that the Treaty of Paris just makes him the prince over America again, but it's because people are purposefully not reading. In the beginning, it talks out, it says, you know, God's been good to change the hearts or soften the hearts of. And then it names the king and all of the things he's over. And then it says, and the United States. Right? Well, hearts is plural, meaning there's two different types of hearts here. It's the king's and all of his titles and the United States. Right? So it's just easy semantics. You can read it, the syntax, and understand what it's actually saying. Some people say that, no, Benjamin Franklin and all them, they actually just... consolidated us back under it, which is dumb because the very article, or the one of the last articles, or this one, sorry, he renounces all claims. Right? It's just people don't read anything. Article 2 sets and acknowledges the boundaries of the United States. Article 3 gives the right to the fishing grounds of Quebec and Newfoundland and northeastern corner of northern America and Canada. Because they were all sharing that anyways. And so it was just saying, we still have a right to go there, you have a right to go there, so on. Article 4, all debts remain collectible from both parties. So basically saying, we're going to honor our debts, even though when we did the Constitution, a lot of the debts didn't get honored because we're like, hey, that was an old government. So we can say what we want there. But the idea was that the debts would be collectible from both parties. And then Article 5, return of property and compensation of property lost to any British loyalists, Tories. So they're making peace all around. Article 6 was indemnify all those that were involved in the war. Article 7 is a peace withdrawal of troops, return and preservation of property and records, and freeing prisoners of war. This is one of my favorite quotes from this, and I think it's profound to me, because this is what we changed into. There shall be a firm and perpetual peace between His Britannic Majesty and the said states, and between the subjects of the one and the citizens of the other. We were no longer subjects. You understand? I mean, that's a profound statement. And, you know, peace and love to all my British friends out there, but I don't know how you can be proud of being somebody's subject. Right? That's why we're proud to be Americans, you know? And then Article 13, Article 8, the Mississippi, and that should be on the other side, it should be IIIX, but anyways. The Mississippi stays open for both parties because that was a big trade route, so they said everybody's going to still have access to that. Article 9 was the retroactive reconciliation, I call it gap insurance. It's basically saying, we're signing it today, it's got to be ratified within 6 months or less. If anything happens between now and then, it's got to all go back right, right? It wasn't, okay, you can do all this bad stuff until, it was saying, something may happen because communications are delayed and so on, but you will go back and restore and make right whatever was wrong during that time period. And then Article 10 was ratification was to be accomplished in 6 months or less, and of course recognition backdated to the moment of signatures. This kind of stuff may seem trivial, but the idea is we have to have an understanding of what these things were. What was the Treaty of Paris? Why did it even exist? What was it establishing, right? The boundaries of the United States, who decided where those are? Where is that recorded? You know, these are the kind of things that we need to understand are in our law and some of the things that our law is pertinent for us to have access to. It's the same thing with, you know, the land out here. Somebody builds on your fence, right? You go to the court where you have the ability to redress that grievance or solve that dispute, and there should be records to prove that. So that's the idea. But to know what we went through, how things changed, we went from being up under the king and everything we did was in the king's name to being free and equal to the king, and everything we're doing now is only in God's name. And then this is a common law, just a little, we're almost done. The common law continued from the first, just to kind of give you a better understanding. The common law system prevails in England, the United States, and other countries colonized by England. It is distinct from the civil law system, which predominates Europe. Okay, and this is all from Westlaw, West Encyclopedia of Law, American Law. Okay, it prevails. It means it's the top law, right? So if you ever run into anybody that says common law is dead in America, it's because they think it's dead, right? It's still ours. It's our birthright, right? And these are the things we have to understand. And last, this is imperative, okay? Because everybody's, it's hard to wrap your head around, well, what are statutes and codes and all this other stuff? But this is a great definition or explanation. It's common law versus Roman civil law. It's not, that's the true definition of it. The civil law system is derived from Roman corpus juris civilis of Emperor Justinian I. In the United States, the term civil law has two meanings, okay? One meaning of civil law refers to a legal system prevalent in Europe that is based on written codes. Civil law, in this sense, is contrasted with the common law system used in England and the United States, which relies on prior case law to resolve disputes rather than written codes. Remember, those case law is also standing on the principles of our rights, right? That's why a lot of the Supreme Court, they hear things based on what our rights are, right? So that's the whole reason. And then those rulings remain paramount. And then the second meaning of civil law refers to the body of laws governing disputes between individuals as opposed to governing criminal offenses. What that simply means is when you go to court, it's either civil or criminal court, right? If we're suing each other, it's civil. If I've broken the law, it's criminal, okay? Well, those two things can house under common law or Roman civil law, the other civil law, right? And what's interesting is when it's, what you have to have in order to have a crime?
Victim.
A victim, right? Right? When you get pulled over for speeding,
no victim.
No crime, right? When you go to jail for growing a substance, right? Or whatever, you know, unless you've hurt somebody. But if doing something like that, no victim, no crime, and it's on your own land, where you're supposed to govern yourself or whatnot, no victim, no crime. So what these actually are, they go into commercial crimes. In other words, they are built into the whole commerce side of everything. Well, what is the commerce side of everything for us, really? It's the marketplace. That's what the government's over. That's what ordinances relate to, right? You can't speed down the road if you're in a box truck because you are working for hire. You've been given that right by the government on behalf of the people, and the people want you to obey the speed limits, right? But not when you're just your personal, you're in your personal capacity, right? And of course, that's a whole nother rabbit trail, and people, you know, get their hair caught on fire when you talk about the speed limits and such. But I mean, think about it. How can they pull you over for not wearing a seatbelt? Who in the world is that hurting? It's a revenue generation. It's a revenue generating machine. That's what it all boils down to. It has nothing to do with giving 2 cents about your protection or your safety, right? But this is a great understanding to be able to see the two differences. Statutes, I'm not saying statutes and laws don't govern people. They do in their certain context or however you're operating it, right? But it's not blanket, and it shouldn't be. And the reality is a lot of the times our justice system crosses over and treats American citizens as if they're businesses, right? Like your friend, Pam, who went through that situation with the prosecutor, right? Calling him or writing him a letter and basically extorting him out of his money without giving him a trial. It didn't come from a grand jury, right? What are you prosecuting, right? There's no due process of law. Pay this money or we're going to prosecute you. Whoa. That's so far outside of our principles. Right? But we don't know that if we don't know our principles.
Right.
All right. And so this I just think is very, very, very profound to me. This is Public Law 97-280. It's found at 96 Stat 1211 from the 97th Congress. So it's the joint resolution from October 4th, 1982, which is under Reagan. Okay. And it says, authorizing and requesting the president to proclaim 1983 as the year of the Bible.
There it is.
Light came on, right?
Yeah,
we're talking
right
about
the year of the
Bible. The year of the Bible. Whereas, now listen to this. Now remember, when they say things, this is in the law.
Technical issues.
This is in the law itself. Okay. Whereas the Bible, comma, the Word of God. So that's our highest legislatures, right? Our highest body of lawmakers and our highest executive all agreeing at the same time and putting in our records that the Bible is the Word of God, right? And so whereas the Bible, the Word of God, has made a unique contribution in shaping the United States as a distinctive and blessed nation and people. Distinctive and blessed because of God's Word. Whereas deeply held religious convictions springing from the Holy Scriptures led to the early settlement of our nation. Whereas biblical teachings inspired concepts of civil government that are contained in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. So the principles of our Declaration, the principles of the Constitution, come from our from God's Word. And whereas many of our great national leaders, among them Presidents Washington, Jackson, Lincoln, and Wilson, paid tribute to the surpassing influence of the Bible in our country's development, as in the words of President Jackson, that the Bible is the rock on which our republic rests, not our democracy. And just so you know, if we focused on everything to do with the Roman civil law, it would be a pure democracy in that sense, right? Whereas the history of our nation clearly illustrates the value of voluntarily applying the teachings of the scriptures in the lives of individuals, families, and societies. That's a very important statement, too, voluntarily applying. We don't make you do it, just like God doesn't make you read his word or submit to his will, right? And then, whereas this nation now faces great challenges that will test this nation as it has never been tested before, sounds very familiar, whereas that renewing our knowledge of and faith in God through Holy Scripture can strengthen us as a nation and a people. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled that the President is authorized and requested to designate 1983 as a National Year of the Bible in recognition of both the formative influence the Bible has been for our nation and our national need to study and apply the teachings of the Holy Scriptures. This is who we are. I don't know if you guys heard when Speaker Johnson got elected, his speech that he gave about the In God We Trust. I had no idea where it came from, and it's fantastic. I just thought it'd always been there. They put it up in there as a statement against communism. A statement against communism so that when they were in there, they would look up there and they would know, understand, and believe that God is the reason we're the nation we are. And it was really a slap in the face to communism. And so the word commie and all this other stuff has gotten pushed to the limit, but it's the true meaning of what these people are doing to us, right? If they do not stand on the principles of God's word, right? Doesn't mean you have to be a Christian, right? Or do any of this kind of stuff, but those are the principles that gave you the freedoms to be in this nation, right? And to be able to stand on our own two feet and to really understand what the law means. And the reason why our common law is so blessed and this nation is so blessed is because it was in obedience and reverence to God. And I think one last slide. This is my motto right now. To do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Proverbs 21:3. And in my heart and my mind, and for what I feel like the Lord has been leading me to, is understanding our law is what he's given us. You got to think about the Christians back in the Roman times, right? They were destroyed and killed for sport. They were hung upside down, belly up, and the lions ate them, right? And they took it, and they stood there, and they took those things with pride because they knew, just like the pilgrim said, they were stepping stones for us. And now God's given us a nation that has protected all of those rights for us and given us the ability to redress them and do whatever, literally, from beginning to end, with the prescribed path, whatever we have to do to continue to secure those rights. And if we don't, then we're letting God down. That's the way I see it. All right, so that's the presentation. We can go ahead and do a question and answer session. Oh, yeah. And if you do have questions, you go to the microphone.
What proverb is that, Josh? I can't read it.
21:3.
Proverbs 21:3. All right. It's really not too many questions I have about this one specifically. For the next course, anything on the chat or anything?
Not on this one. Nothing.
So the next course will be on the Constitution itself. And it won't be the history or the Constitution. It will be the Constitution, right? So it will be parsed out so you can understand it. My goal is to pick it apart into subject matter so that we can go through. It won't be exhaustive, right? It will just be, these are the things that this stands for. This is the article this stands for. And the goal really is if you're dealing with things that are an issue, you go back to that, right? And you're like, okay, cool. If I'm looking into what the judiciary, what the justice system should be doing, or what the limits on the executive branch are, or whatever the case is, you'll be able to go back and find those specific things and maneuver through it a lot easier. Because if we know it, based on that, and it's subsected, is that the right word? Turn it into sections. Then you have the ability, you know, to really pick it apart easier, and it's not just this one huge document. Okay.
Nice.
And then is Chuck?
Yeah.
Okay. I couldn't see you because the ring of light.
Right. Ring of fire.
So if you would come up and tell everybody about your awakening attack.
You
want to
say this?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know if we were going to put it on there.
Probably not.
All right, so for everybody watching and whatnot, we're going to end the episode, and then we will be back in 2 weeks with the Constitution.
Right on the hour and 2 minutes.
John.